Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Aaron Brown, sitting in today for Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is the death of free choice and free people. Should the state decide what clothes children should wear? I first want to welcome our special guest, Dr. Sean Gabb. Hello, Dr. Gabb.
Hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm excellent. Glad to have you here. Dr. Gabb is the director of the Libertarian Alliance. He's a former economic advisor to the Prime Minister of Slovakia, has written over a dozen books, numerous articles, and is a tireless advocate of freedom over there in the UK. This show is based mostly on an article Dr. Gabb wrote called Should the State Decide What Clothes Children Are Allowed to Wear? He has been waging a campaign against these proposed new laws with articles, TV appearances, radio appearances, etc. So first off, Sean, could you just tell us exactly what these new proposed laws actually contain in them?
Right. If I were to say that this is a proposal for a definite criminal law, I think I'd be exaggerating. The way things are done over here, probably the same over there as well, is that you have these various pressure groups and civil servants in the British Home Office, in your case in the Department of Homeland Security, whatever, and they sit down, they reach some kind of agreement, and then they announce various voluntary codes which private businesses sign up to without any apparent coercion. And then these are adopted by various state-run schools and institutions, and they become de facto the law without ever having been made into the criminal law. But the idea is that some parents are accused of dressing their daughters like little prostitutes, high-heel shoes, padded bras, revealing shorts, showing off their bellies, you know, the sort of thing, and that this is sexualizing children as young as 4 years old, etc., and that this is encouraging paedophiles to attack children, and that it really is necessary for all persons of goodwill to get together and do something about this. Now, that is the way in which the law is being presented, or the policy is being presented. You can be quite sure, however, there's no point at this stage in our history saying the authorities are fundamentally decent people, but there are one or two bad people among them, or they're sometimes overzealous, and that we should trust in the authorities, but we should try to persuade them to behave in a more sensible manner. No, that's 20, 30 years out of date. Any law that you give the authorities will be abused.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that later in the show, because I really want you to expand on those ideas, because they're really quite profound just in, you know, talking about the nature of the state. But I think it's useful just to recognize the fact that prohibition in all its forms, it just doesn't work. It doesn't matter what you're trying to outlaw. So even if...
It depends what you're trying to do. If you're trying to outlaw certain kinds of clothing, if you're trying to stop children from watching certain kinds of television program, and if their parents are not willing to act as parents, then no, of course there's nothing the authorities can do. But if you look at this as another excuse for jobs, status, and income for various clients of the ruling class, then it would be a brilliant success.
Mm-hmm.
Just as drug prohibition has been so brilliantly successful in the United States. If you believe that the purpose of drug prohibition in America is to reduce the number of narcotics that people ingest, then yes, it has been a disaster, a catastrophe, no less. But if you assume that it is an excuse for an enormous bureaucratic expansion of government, for relaxed due process rules for the police and the courts, and generally as an excuse
We're coming up close to the end of this first segment, but
yes.
We're going to be back with Dr. Sean Gabb talking about should the state decide what clothes children should wear. We'll be back on Radio Free Market after this break. Stay with us. Hello, America. We are back with Dr. Sean Gabb on Radio Free Market. And, Sean, I wanted to cut you off. I wanted to let you continue that thought about how success, the way free people define it, is a little bit different than the way the state defines it.
Yes, indeed. I was using the example of the war on drugs, which is waged in America with rather more vigor than it is in England. If you assume the purpose of the various drug control laws in America is to reduce the number of narcotics that people ingest, it has been a failure, a disastrous failure, a catastrophic failure. I leave that to you. But if you define the purpose of the anti-drug laws in America as the expansion of bureaucratic control over the population, as a very important employer of people, as a legitimization of authority, and as a general signal to the people of who is the boss, then it has been a brilliant success. And the purpose of any kind of ban on clothing for children in England will be much the same. You really cannot stop irresponsible or malevolent parents from bringing their children up badly. But you can certainly tell the people out there who is the boss and who had better be obeyed. And I think this law or policy, whatever you want to call it, would be one more step towards that kind of total shepherd state.
Mm-hmm. And you pointed out something that's it's often overlooked during these discussions about, you know, when you involve the state and legislating morality, and was really kind of opened my, you said in a very in a way that really hit me, and that is to implement these controls, policies, whatever you want to call them, the people are going to put power in the hands of people they don't know. They have their own agenda. Furthermore, they get their revenue by stealing it from them. You know, so can you explain and expand on that idea? Because I listened to a radio interview you did, and you explained it. I thought it was very compelling.
Right, thank you. Let's assume for the sake of argument, that some parents are indeed bringing their children up in the most irresponsible way. Now, if you call for the authorities to make a law against irresponsible parenting, you are giving power into the hands of people you do not know, who are in no meaningful sense accountable to you, whose agenda may well be very different from your own, and who will sooner or later use the powers you have given them in ways that you find surprising or in ways that shock your own deepest moral principles. The assumption of many of the people pushing for this ban on indecent children's clothing is that the authorities are fundamentally decent Christian people. Now, that is a naive assumption, especially in England, where there is a low-level war being conducted by the authorities against any kind of normal Christianity. And it is just so bizarre to watch these people at work. So when I say these people, I mean concerned Christians. Okay, they may well have a point that some parents are being irresponsible in the way they dress their children and in the kind of things they allow their children to watch on television. Let's not argue over that. I don't do it, and most parents don't do it, but some parents do. Let's just accept that. But their further assumption that they can somehow get the authorities to act in a Christian way to stamp out sinful behavior, even if you assume that that is a legitimate function of the state, even if you assume that that is a legitimate thing for Christians to do, it is naive to expect that the authorities we have, the actually existing authorities, to behave in any way other than they do. And this law, if it is made, controlling children's clothing to try to stamp out indecency, will be abused. One of these days, we shall read in the newspapers that the police and social workers dragged a little girl away from a family picnic and photographed her chest, just to see if the wording on her T-shirt is indecent. Or they'll drag her away and measure the heels on her shoes, wondering if they're just a quarter inch too long. This is how such a power, if given, will be used. There's no doubt of that in my mind.
And it's not even a theoretical. It's not like you're, as if you're talking about some fantasy world. I mean, this is what we were told in America when the body scanners went in. They said, no, the pictures will not be saved. They're deleted as soon. And then, you know, of course, months later, we find out that they are stored in a database and some of the TSA agents are taking them home or whatever they did. Somehow these pictures are, you know, they're stored and they are able to use them. And, you know, of course, as you said, this is, we're supposed to believe this is the accident. This is the exception.
No, these are bad people. Let me say something. I'm over the age of 50, only just, but yes, I'm over the age of 50. And I was brought up in an England where fundamentally you could trust the authorities to do the decent thing. Yes, there were one or two corrupt policemen. There were one or two policemen who beat up suspects to get confessions out of them. However, let's face it, most of the people so beaten up and so set up had done the crime of which they were accused or they'd done something else. But broadly speaking, you could trust the authorities. There were people like you, people on your side, and you could trust them to behave moderately and with common sense. Now, anyone who still believes that is not only deluded in his own mind, but he is a menace to himself and to everybody else. The authorities in England, and from what I read in the newspapers and on the internet, in the United States as well, are not fundamentally decent people on the side of other decent people. They are parts of a machine which is running completely out of control and is imposing some weird kind of totalitarian humanism on their populations. You cannot trust these people, and you cannot consent to their further empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
There may be nothing we can do to stop their further empowerment, but we should never consent to it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I came onto this about 2 to 3 years ago, and, you know, of course, you know, family and friends, sometimes they just don't want to, just aren't interested in listening to it. But it was interesting, I had an extended family member comment to me on how when they were younger in the United States, you could, like you said, you can, in general, trust people and do what you'd like as long as you didn't hurt another person. But he commented on how punitive the system is now, and I thought that was somewhat encouraging that people are at least waking up to it, but also discouraging that it's going in this direction. But I wanted to, you said something in one of your interviews that the laws that are now existing and the proposed laws that are going to come into existence, you said that the social control that is imposed on parents, in the UK in particular, has relegated parents to the status somewhat of glorified babysitters. And this, it might be startling to some people and kind of hard to admit, but I want to let you comment on that because I tend to agree.
Yes. Again, you know, some American jurisdictions may actually be worse than in England. The presumption of the authorities is that any uncertified adult around children is a danger to children, and this includes parents. And you know, when my daughter was born a couple of years ago, we were visited by a health worker who actually showed us a few interesting things about how to wash her, how to do this, how to do that. But she went away, and none of these people have ever come back. But there are parts of the country where social workers, health visitors, all of these people amount to a vast and unaccountable supervisory power over children, so that parents really are relegated to the status of what you call glorified babysitters, or I called them, little more than childminders, that's
childminders, yes.
Childminders, yes. Glorified childminders. But glorified babysitters is even better. On the positive side, if you're white and middle class in England, none of this actually means anything. As I said, when my daughter was born, they came round, they made a few vague efforts. When they realised that we were very unlikely to murder our child or eat her or offer her up for satanic child abuse, they just went away and they've never come back since. But, you know, if you're not white and middle class or if you live in the wrong area, it can be rather difficult with the child welfare authorities. Again, on the positive side, you know, we have absolutely no controls in this country on home education. You don't need to explain that. You don't need to explain to the authorities that you are educating your child at home. You don't need to show lesson plans to anybody. You don't even need to tell the authorities that you're doing it. You just don't send your child to school. If you get a letter from the authorities, you say, "I'm educating my child otherwise," and they're not allowed to inquire into what you're doing. We actually have one of the most liberal home education legal regimes in the world, and the country is, Britain is filling up with refugees from elsewhere in the European Union where home education is illegal. So, okay, I live in a semi-totalitarian state, but there are still little islands here and there which indicate that the country was once a great deal more free than it is nowadays.
And the homeschooling, that's huge. I know here it is it's very regulated.
Yeah.
And we have about 30 seconds before the next break. In our next segment, we're going to discuss some of the aspects of the media and how the media kind of helps to, certainly doesn't help to slow down this this sort of agenda for social control. And we're coming into the end of this break, so we're going to be back with Dr. Sean Gabb talking about the death of free choice and free people on Radio Free Market. We will be back. Please stay with us. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market, and I wanted to talk to you about some of the radio interviews and appearances, and I've been getting a lot of publicity for this kind of campaign you're waging against these new proposed laws. And we're beginning to see, or not even beginning, just depends on how long you've been looking at it, that not just in the UK, but also around the entire world, people are beginning to see it's a complete fantasy that the media or the press will keep the politicians accountable.
Yes. Well, if you look through history, you'll find that every stable regime, every stable absolutist regime, has required its court poets and propagandists, people who will tell the poets who will tell the people, "You're living in the best of possible worlds, and God smiles kindly upon the king." Now, we don't quite have that nowadays. What we have instead is the mainstream media. The idea is that these people are committed to investigating every possible abuse of power and will keep the authorities in check. They are the transmission belt between the people at large and the democratically elected politicians who govern our countries. The truth, of course, is that the mainstream media is not utterly corrupt, but is pretty well utterly corrupt. There is a symbiotic relationship between the mainstream media and the government, partly because the mainstream media gets most of its information from the government. News releases about statistics of unemployment, notification of interest rate changes, all sorts of stuff gets into the newspapers and the general mainstream media via government news handouts. And so the mainstream media will not do anything to jeopardize that relationship. You then have the fact the owners of the media are effectively part of the same ruling class as the politicians come from. And then you have the self-selection of the kind of people who work in the mainstream media. In Britain, for example, I imagine it's much the same in America, but I speak of Britain because of the country I know best. In Britain, if you want to work on a newspaper or for the BBC or any of the independent broadcasters, you need to have a degree in media studies from an appropriate university, and the universities are staffed by people who are friendly to big government And so if you study a media studies course, if you follow a media studies course, you will spend 3 years immersed in an intellectual environment that regards a large and powerful and activist government as not necessarily a bad thing. And that means that the kinds of people who work in the mainstream media are predisposed to look kindly on, not on every action of the government, but they're inclined to look very kindly on the general existence of the big government. And so our kind of ideas will not get much of an airing in the mainstream media. Again, you know, I don't want to paint a picture darker than it really is. In Britain, we have the BBC, which is, I won't talk about who owns it because it's rather hard to explain, but it is a state broadcasting organisation. It has a royal charter which says that it must present a balanced view of issues. It doesn't do that very well, but it does it, which is one reason why I'm always on the BBC. The BBC does have a limited commitment to putting the other side on most issues, and so it is better in that respect than many American media organizations.
Mm-hmm. And to give an example for our listeners of kind of media involvement in this, one of the organizations called Media Watch UK, which is mm-hmm. has been very active in pushing for these controls, we have about 2 minutes. Can you tell us about the interesting history of this supposedly unbiased media organization?
Oh, right. Okay. The Media Watch UK is a rebranded, it's rebranded National Viewers and Listeners Association. This was set up in the early 1960s in England by a woman called Mary Whitehouse, a remarkable individual, in many ways admirable and quite perceptive, but she had an agenda of censorship. She believed that England was under the judgment of God for its sins. First of all, God punished us by taking away the empire. When we didn't repair our ways, God gave us a Labour government. When we still didn't repair our ways, she decided that she had to step in and stop all of the sex and violence being shown on the television. She spent the 1960s, 70s and 80s campaigning indefatigably for tight state censorship of what could be shown in cinemas, on television screens, and indeed what could be shown in the print media. She didn't succeed, and she died a disappointed woman. But her successors in the rebranded and much more media sharp Media Watch UK, they may succeed where she didn't, because these people look soft and gentle and moderate, and they sit down with civil servants behind closed doors, and it is possible that they will get by stealth what Mary Whitehouse tried and failed to get by running high-profile media campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And we have about 30 seconds left in this segment, but I listened to a radio interview you did that I found, I think it was with BBC Three Counties Radio. And all these, you can find all these media appearances on Sean Gabb, that's SEANGABB.co.uk. And it was just interesting the range of opinion that the television show hosts tried to kind of force you into. So I thought that was really interesting. And when we get back from this next break, I'll give you a chance to comment on that. We're here on Radio Free Market with Dr. Sean Gabb. Stay with us. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market with Dr. Sean Gabb. So I wanted to give you a chance to talk about a radio interview you did where you were talking about these laws that are proposing to regulate what children wear. And the radio interviewer tried to force you into, well, it's either you support these controls or you support girls walking around like prostitutes. And that was it. Those are the only two options.
Yes, well, this is something I've come across in the American media as well. It's something general to the English-speaking media. You allow on a dissenting voice within this debate, and they have set up a dichotomy. Either you are a concerned person who wants to use the power of the state to do the right thing, or you are an amoral psychopath who rather likes whatever it is that the concerned people want to do something about. And so in this case, either you want laws controlling the kind of clothing that children wear, or you're quite happy for children to walk around dressed as prostitutes. Now, of course, the third position is that there are some irresponsible parents. This is very sad, but there is nothing you can do about those people using the power of the state without subjecting the great majority of perfectly responsible parents to an absolute and arbitrary tyranny over their lives, and that it's much better to stand back and say some children will turn out rather badly rather than turn parents into glorified babysitters, which is what these people are largely calling for.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's whenever I look at people, instead of just directly interacting, instead of maybe, I'm sure there's some parents, like you said, the conservative authoritarians who don't want their child going to school with the girl who dresses however she wants to wear, even if it's risque or inappropriate or whatever. But instead of, now we're in a society where instead of maybe going to those parents and having, you know, a conversation with another human being, we outsource that, you know, that discomfort that we feel, or not me, but people, you know, outsource that task to the state that solves it by violence. So now, yeah, instead of just having a society that's kind of based off interaction and talking with your neighbor and trying to work out problems, it's violence, and we have to go to this authoritarian power structure.
Well, yes, but that's the way it's being set up. Again, I don't know how it works in America. When I was a boy, if my mother had a problem with another parent, or if a parent had a problem with my mother or my father, you just go and knock on the door, and you have it out there and then. You have a discussion about this. It may actually end up, the discussion may well end up with going inside and having a cup of tea. But the point is, you cannot do that nowadays. If I were to go and knock on someone's door and say, I don't like the influence your child is having on my daughter, a number of things could happen. I probably wouldn't get a punch on the nose, though I might. But what is much more likely is that the aggrieved parent will telephone the police and say that I came and behaved in a threatening and abusive manner, or will telephone the social services and say that I'm an irresponsible parent myself. And the whole dialogue will turn into some long, drawn-out nightmare in which I may actually face criminal charges. Now, we all face that threat. You can't actually go and knock on a neighbor's door in this country and say, can you turn that radio down? I'm trying to sleep. What you do instead, so far as possible, is have all interactions with other adults in this country mediated through the authorities, because otherwise you may find yourself in court charged with various spurious offenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's more or less how it works here, and I'm reminded of Albert J. Nock wrote a book called Our Enemy, the State, and because the state is so big, the bigger the state gets, the more state power is, the less social power there is.
Oh, yes. The force of public opinion in little things is of no value nowadays, because you cannot go up to... If I saw somebody in the street walking along with a seven-year-old child dressed up like a prostitute, I would not under any circumstances go up to that person and say, do you not think this is a rather irresponsible way to bring up your daughter? Because that person, again, probably wouldn't assault me, but might well telephone the police and accuse me of having behaved in a threatening and abusive manner. And although the police might eventually go away, I just don't have the time or inclination to deal with this kind of thing. And so what I will do is I'll look the other way, I'll walk by on the other side, and there is no use of social power worth mentioning in this country.
Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful things I thought that you said during the interview you did with the BBC Three Counties Radio, that was the one I listened to, was that no matter what the lawmakers say about how the law will be enforced, no matter how they say the authorities will be restrained and with care for the public good, the way it is implemented will be violent and it will be authoritarian. Can you comment on that?
Well, yes. Look, in America and in Britain, we've seen this endlessly. The authorities bring in a law saying this is needed because a tough law of this kind is needed because of the facts on the ground. We need to do something about this. But this is a purely exceptional power. It will be used moderately and proportionately. And these strange libertarians jumping up and down, claiming that it will be used in an oppressive way, are lunatics. They're grossly exaggerating. The power will not and cannot be used in this way. And then we've seen it used in exactly this way. Look, we had a new Terrorism Act brought in about 8 years ago, and we were told this will be used only in exceptional circumstances. Someone got up at a meeting, a political meeting that was being addressed by the Home Secretary, and heckled him, said, "You're talking nonsense." The police promptly arrested this man, who was an 85...
For heckling?
Yes, heckling a cabinet minister. They took him outside and charged him with a terrorism offence, or they arrested him for a terrorism offence, didn't charge him.
Wow.
There was a man walking along a towpath, which is the path alongside a canal where horses used to pull barges. It was a restricted area, apparently, and he was arrested under the Terrorism Act. There was a man who went up to the cenotaph in Whitehall, which is a monument built to the dead of the Great War, and he quietly, without drawing the attention to himself, recited the names of all the British wounded in Iraq. He was again arrested by the police under the terrorism laws, and he now has a criminal record because of this. And these laws are used in petty ways, not because they are badly implemented, not because they're badly enforced, not because the officers involved are insensitive or improperly trained. The abuse is the purpose of the law.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain and in America, we've long had perfectly adequate laws for dealing with people who want to let off bombs in public places. We have laws going back to before the American Revolution that make this a very serious criminal offence. All of the new laws we've been given in the past 20 years, what have you, they have done nothing to make us safer. They have simply been a license for greater police and general executive control over ordinary people.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone listening, if you go to YouTube, there's actually a show on Russia Today and the host is kind of, a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, his name is Adam Kokesh, and actually he and a few, and I think about 20 other people or 30 other people, went to the Jefferson Memorial and put their iPhones in their ears. They weren't, playing really loud music and disturbing the public, and they were dancing, doing slow dancing, and the U.S. Park Police body slammed these people to the ground and arrested them. So, I don't know under what law they were arrested under, but, it just, again, just shows how, the new laws are about, they're just, as you say, they're part of just this agenda of social control. And you wrote that it's really incredible to think that tens of thousands of people, their only justification for employment is their role in controlling pretty much every aspect of our lives. I remember a friend remarked to me the other day that in the U.S. approximately 3 million people are directly or indirectly employed in the service of tax compliance. So could you talk to us just about that, the agenda of social control, that the as you say, these what people think are the accidents, you know, the police brutality, these are kind of the intended consequences, not the unintended.
They are. The massive expansion of government in Britain and America over the past few generations has inevitably attracted a number of very bad people into positions of considerable importance, or simply a large number of bad and stupid people at the bottom. You also have the fact, as Hayek pointed out on The Road to Serfdom, that when you have a gigantically extended state apparatus, the only way that you can keep control of this is by being a nasty piece of work yourself. But probably most of the people who are most of the people who are running this gigantic machine of social control are not bad people. Many of them may even be rather well-meaning, but the point is they have the same interest as any other bureaucratic interest group, which is to expand their numbers, their status, and their income. And so these people will be continually looking for new problems. They will be talking intensively to supposedly independent pressure groups. In this country, we call them fake charities. And they will be giving the politicians long lists of terrible problems which can only be solved by further state action. It is a machine used for manufacturing laws. It's hard to, you can point at individual politicians and many senior bureaucrats, and you can say these are bad people. These people want a totalitarian police state. But probably most of the people at the bottom couldn't care less. They're just doing their job. But they are undoubtedly being thoroughly corrupted along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, what we're talking about for our listeners on the show is it's not that it's just this in nefarious kind of conspiracy. These people are looking after their own self-interest, and the way for the state to get more revenue, like you said, is just to make more laws. It's as simple as that. It's just about making jobs and gaining power. So it's nothing earth-shattering. It's nothing secretive. The way that the state is able to obtain more revenue. There's an Ayn Rand quote, I forget what it is, that you cannot rule innocent men, so the way to make more guilty people is just to make more laws. And I thought that was interesting.
Again, it's worse in America because there are more of you, and you have a federal government and 52 state governments, which gives much more scope for making many more laws. But in this country, I think we have something like 500,000 pages of various kinds of laws which have criminal penalties attached to them, tax laws, various kinds of regulation, real criminal laws, pseudo-criminal laws, and the rest of it. You have hundreds of thousands of pages of this stuff. No one's read it all. No one even knows what all these laws are. But what it means is that probably I am breaking some British law at the moment by talking to you, and you're probably breaking some American law by talking to me. We don't know what that law is, and let's be honest, the law will never be used against people like you and me. But probably everything you do from the moment you wake up to the moment you fall asleep is or could be classified as illegal if the authorities want it to. Now, when you have this kind of wall-to-wall criminal lawmaking, it means that people, you can get anyone for anything if you want to. And the only reason we can call ourselves free men is because we live in countries where that is the tradition, and because the authorities have not yet decided to do us over. Mm-hmm. But if you are in the large and growing class of people disliked by the authorities, your life can be made into a petty nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And we have about two more minutes left in this segment, and I wanted to ask you this one question before we ended it. One of the toughest things to do is to keep kind of a logical mind when you're assaulted with emotional claims, like on these shows. you know, the government is doing this to protect the kiddies, as you say. You know, we're doing this to protect the kiddies, to protect the kiddies from the bad parents. But as you say, this rhetoric is, you know, vast majority of the time, simply to cover the real goal of controlling adults.
Yes. I would like to say...
Go ahead.
I would like to say that by continually exposing the agenda of these fake charities and of these state officials, that we can somehow stop them from making these laws. That, I'm afraid, is naive. The laws were decided on far in advance of being announced. All we can do is bear witness to the fact that our countries are being turned into totalitarian police states. Rolling this stuff back is probably for another generation.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. In the next segment, well, let's get started on this question. We have about a minute left. But in Republic here, you know, I can only speak of the United States. I don't know party politics as well in the UK. You know, in Republican as well as some Tea Party circles, there are cries, you know, accusing the Muslim countries of Islamofascism. But as one of the writers on the Libertarian Alliance blog wrote, the way the British and U.S. governments do business is quite literally no different in function than the way Islamic states do theirs. You have about 30 seconds, but we'll continue this discussion into the next segment.
Yes, okay. In Islamic states, you have a body of religious scholars called the Ulema, and then you have a religious police called the Mutahin, and the religious scholars tell the authorities what laws to make, and the religious police enforce those laws. And it's all done in a very quaint medieval fashion, a rather brutal medieval fashion in Islamic states. It's not really that much different in Britain and America. It's a matter of clothing and language and behavior. But
and we will let you describe a little more of that when we get back from this segment. Please stay with us on Radio Free Market. Welcome back, America. We're a Radio Free Market. And Dr. Gab, I want to let you continue that that comment on kind of the way the U.S. and British governments implement laws is no different than the way Islamic states do theirs, yet we criticize the way they do it.
Well, we criticize the ways that they do it for all sorts of reasons that are probably not important. The important thing is that we believe that we are liberal democratic states. I'm using liberal in the English, in the British sense of libertarian, in which the people elect politicians, the politicians make laws which they have promised before being elected to the people, and the media then keeps some kind of watchful eye on the politicians. The truth, however, is that laws are decided behind closed doors by various pressure groups and bureaucracies. These are then announced, these are then given to the politicians who sell them to the public using the mainstream media as a kind of amplification mechanism. And you then have an army of police officers, social workers, general bureaucrats to enforce this stuff on the people. It is not so very different from the way in which an authoritarian Islamic state operates. The main difference, I would say, nowadays is that whereas in authoritarian Islamic states, the authorities enforce laws which are broadly acceptable to the people, in Britain and America, a very similar system operates to enforce laws which are not acceptable to the people, but there's nothing we can do about it, is there?
No, not too much, unless... You know, and I guess that is why we're doing what we're doing right now, to try and get people to wake up and realize that this is not the way it has to be. And to that point, there's a book, a small book that I encourage all of our listeners to read that I've mentioned before, called Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. And that is the whole reason we're doing this show is to help people to understand that, as Rothbard writes, we are not the government. The government is not us. The government does not, in really any accurate sense, represent the people. But, Sean, people still continue to believe that people in government who are paid by money that was stolen from us by other people in the government still believe that those people have our best interests in mind.
Yes. Let me say something that might be rather shocking to your listeners, which is that, so far as I can tell, most people in America, certainly white, most white middle-class people, believe that they live in a republic with laws that are legitimated by how far they are compatible with a constitution agreed in 1787. I must say that looking into America as an outsider, what I see is a very different kind of constitution. The real American constitution is this. The authorities can make any law they please and implement that law in any manner they please, so long as it does not produce widespread armed resistance and so long as some very expensive lawyers can be hired to argue that black is white in front of a committee of judges appointed by the politicians who make those laws in the first place. That does seem to be the Constitution of the United States in fact, as opposed to in theory. Sadly, it's much the same in Britain, but it's a point that I would make, because I do look at the Tea Party stuff, which is all about restoring the American Constitution, making sure that the American Constitution is respected, praising the American Constitution. But let's face it, the American Constitution, as it was made in 1787, has been effectively suspended for generations. How many of the laws under which you operate are actually validated by that constitution read in its natural language? I don't think many at all are.
Nope. And Sean Gabb, I would love to have you back on another show, but we've got to get out of here for today. Thank you to Dr. Sean Gabb for being with us today. This is Aaron Brown and Radio Free Market. You can visit us and download our stuff on iTunes or go to radiofreemarket.com. Thank you, and wherever you are, stand up for freedom.